Hiring isn't just about finding someone willing to take the job. You need the right person with the right background who can move your business forward. If you want candidates who truly match what you're looking for, trust Indeed Sponsored Jobs. With Indeed Sponsored Jobs, your post stands out to quality candidates who actually fit the role. According to Indeed data, 90% are more likely to be hired and trusted by 1.6 million companies. Spend more time interviewing candidates who check all your boxes. Less stress, less time, more results. Now with Indeed Sponsored Jobs. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to help your job get the premium status it deserves at Indeed.com/podcast12. Just go to Indeed.com/podcast12 right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Indeed.com/podcast12. Terms and conditions apply. Hiring? Do it the right way with Indeed.
Today on The Grave Talks, the Morris Jumel Mansion. On the island of Manhattan in 1765, Roger Morris constructed his summer getaway, what would later be known as the Morris Jumel Mansion. The property would become far more than just a summer hideaway. It would play a key role in multiple battles and conflicts in early American history. George Washington would use the house as a headquarters, and many others would find solace behind its walls, including Vice President Aaron Burr. Could these spirits still roam the haunted Morris Jumel Mansion? Death, innovation, affairs, love, secret murder, suicide, wars, and unrest are just a fraction of the many emotions that were expelled in this house through its more than 250-year history. Today, the haunted Morris Jumel Mansion is home to multiple spirits. Ghosts who haunt the mansion, likely the same people who once called it home. Today, we talk with paranormal investigator Vincent Carbone about the haunted Morris Jumel Mansion.
So the Morris Jumel Mansion, located in Washington Heights, Manhattan, it is the oldest house, the oldest surviving house in the borough of Manhattan, which is pretty crazy to think about, especially because we get people that come here every day that have actually never heard of it. So for such a popular city to have such a historical location that they haven't heard of is pretty fascinating. But nonetheless, this house was built originally in 1765 by a British colonel. His name was Roger Morris. And he was a veteran of the French and Indian War. And he had a house down on Pearl Street in Manhattan. And so he builds this house as a summer getaway for him and his family. Now, he's married to a woman named Mary Phillipsy. And her family was very well known all throughout Westchester County because they have a lot of tobacco plantations and a lot of wealth of their own. So he actually marries into the wealth, which is not the other way around, which was common back then. She was so popular and so well known, and she was a beautiful woman as well, but she would have suitors coming from all over the country to ask her hand in marriage. And one of those gentlemen was from Virginia, and he was known as George Washington. This is before he was a general. But nonetheless, Roger Morris ends up marrying her, and they build this as their summer getaway. And right now we're surrounded by buildings on all sides, but when this was first built, it would be the equivalent of 40 city blocks and river to river. So that gives you an idea of the magnitude of how large his property was and how expansive it was. And from here, it's the second highest point in New York. From here, you could see out to Connecticut, Long Island, New Jersey, which comes into play later on when Washington comes here and takes it over. So basically what happens is Morris, you know, he retires from the military, builds his house, he comes here. And then after about 10 years or so, the revolution breaks out and the British want him to go back into fighting. And he says, no, I've been there, done that. I'm not going back to war. So he actually goes back to England, and Washington, who he actually fought alongside during the French and Indian War, knows of the house. They weren't friends, but they were definitely like they knew of each other. They may have worked together and navigating throughout the French and Indian War. But so Washington's getting beat up out in Brooklyn and Long Island. So he knows that this house is now vacant. So what he does is he sends the troops ahead to secure the land. And then Washington comes here and is here for 5 weeks. So Washington is living here. He's encamped here. In the Octagon Room on the first floor, he held his court-martial hearings. Upstairs on the second floor, we have his bedroom and his war office. And so he's here for, like I said, 5 weeks. And it's actually while he's staying here, he has a major turning point for him in the war. He has one of his first major victories just south of here at the Battle of Harlem Heights. But what happens is he's almost captured by the British. So he actually retreats and he takes off up to Westchester. So then what happens is the British come in, they take over the house, and they set up the house, and they implant the Hessians. And if you remember from American history in school, Hessians were the German mercenaries fighting on behalf of the British. Now, side note, why are Germans involved in this war at all? It's because Wilhelm von Hest, the commander of the German army, is cousins with King George. So he basically was helping his cousin out by lending his troops. Nonetheless, the Hessians are here for a couple of months. And this is where we get our first rumor of what could lead to a potential haunting here at the mansion. It's believed that the Hessians stayed up on the third floor, which is now our attic, one of our two attics, and which is now our offices. But the Hessians would have been staying up there, and the officers would have been staying in the larger bedrooms on the second floor. Nonetheless, it's believed that a Hessian soldier was running down from the third floor to the second floor, tripped, and falls and lands on his bayonet and bleeds to death on the stairs. So that's where we get our first rumor. So then after a couple of months, the Hessians, they kind of move on. And then this gentleman named Talmadge Hall, he's a business owner, and he buys a stagecoach business, a route, from here all the way up to Albany in upstate New York. So what he does is he goes, hey, you know what? While these people are traveling on my stagecoach business, let me buy that vacant Morris house. And then he turns it into basically an inn. It becomes a tavern. It's called Talmadge Hall's Inn, and he has it for about 2 years. And in that 2 years, basically, it's like, hey, while you're traveling, come stay at my place, you know, along the way. Because, you know, obviously no subways, there was hardly any roads to really speak of at that time in New York, so which is hard to believe now. But so it was a pretty long trip to get up to Albany. So people would stay here overnight for a day or two, and they would get, you know, have a place to stay. They would have something to eat, something to drink, and then they would carry on with their journey. So unfortunately for Talmadge, the business goes belly up after about 2 years. And so when that happens, it basically goes up for auction, and it just sits there for about 15 to 20 years. The house is actually just vacant. Now, what happens in that time is anyone's guess. But for the most part, from what we understand, it's just vacant. Then in 1810, a French wine merchant named Stephen Jamel buys the house, basically for song and dance. And he gets it relatively cheap. He buys it as a wedding present for his wife, Eliza Jamel. Now, this is where we get the second name of the museum. You got Morris for Roger Morris, and then Jamel for Stephen Jamel. There was not a gentleman named Morris Jamel. It was two different families that owned the house. So Roger Morris, he's a French wine merchant. He's going back and forth to England, you know, on different business dealings. He meets his wife, Eliza. Now, Eliza's from Providence, Rhode Island, and she grows up really, really poor. She moves to New York as a teenager with her sister, and she moves here to pursue a career in theater and in music. And she actually meets Stephen at the theater. Now, the rumor is, and the story goes, is that she was actually the other woman in Stephen's life. He was already engaged to someone else, or even married, meets Eliza, and they kind of they hit it off. And now there's an old urban legend, and whether or not this is true, if it's not, nonetheless, it's great, it's theatrical, but she basically tells Stephen, I'm dying. You know, she tells him that she's dying. And so please make an honest woman out of me before I pass and go on to heaven. Can you marry me? So he does. He marries her on her deathbed. And lo and behold, she pops up out of bed and she's fine all of a sudden. So So she got what she wanted, but she was, you know, that's one of many stories that contribute to her very bright personality, let's just say. But nonetheless, they're married. They move here in 1810. And despite the fact that she grows up relatively poor, she actually helps Stephen quadruple his worth. She's self-taught in French. She starts collecting artwork from all over the world. And she actually becomes one of the first female landowners in the state of New York. And so Stephen, you know, he kind of just steps aside and lets her do her thing because he sees that she knows what she's doing somehow and just it's working out. So sure, let her do her thing. And it works out really well for him. What happens is that he passes away in 1832. Now, depending on who you ask, you're going to get two different stories as to how he passed away. One is either he fell on a pitchfork when he was on a hay cart. He fell on a pitchfork, gets carried back to the house. He gets bandaged up, and then Eliza dismisses all of the doctors and nurses and says, I'll take care of him. They return in the morning, and the bandages have been removed, and he's bled to death. That's one story. The other story is that he just died of pneumonia. I'm going to get into later on where that first story came from. Because it's pretty interesting and it's also kind of unfortunate. Nonetheless, he dies in 1832. Roughly a year later, former Vice President Aaron Burr comes knocking and he asks for her hand in marriage. And he actually tries several times and she turns him down. Then she finally one day says, you know what? He's got the name. I've got the money. It's going to be a good benefit for me socially to do this. So they get married because remember Eliza and Stephen were nouveau riche. They would be invited to the New York elite parties, but no one would talk to them. You know, he was a Frenchman, she was an actor from out of town, so they wanted nothing to do with them. So she was constantly trying to find a way to be accepted into New York society. And she figured, you know, why not marry former vice president? Now, at this point in his life, he had done all of his damage politically. He was already vice president. He already tried to annex part of the country here and all that. And he escaped being tried for treason. So now he's in his 70s. She's in her 50s. They're together for about 8 months. And then she starts to realize two things. Number one, a lot of the money that she's developed for herself starts disappearing. Why? Because now he's trying to cover his legal debts and misspending that he's racked up over his life. And number two, at the age of mid-70s or so, he starts keeping time with a 24-year-old girl. So Eliza hears about this and does something extremely unheard of at that time, and she files for divorce. Okay. Now, there's another urban legend surrounding Eliza, and this whole story is that of all of the attorneys in New York that she could have approached to represent her in the divorce proceedings, one of the first attorneys that she went to was Alexander Hamilton Jr. Why that's important is because anyone who's seen the musical or knows anything about American history and all that is that Burr kills Hamilton in the duel over in Weehawken, New Jersey. Now, whether or not that's true, I don't know. It makes for a great story, but nonetheless, they do get a divorce. It takes 2 years for this divorce to go through. The week it's to be finalized, Burr has a stroke over on Staten Island. And the morning they're to appear in court, he passes away. So what happens is she ends up going on as the Widow Burr, which is exactly what she wanted to begin with. So she keeps the name, he dies, and she goes on with her life. And she lives out the rest of her life. She doesn't get remarried. She dies in 1865 in the house, in the bed that we still have here in the museum. She dies in 1865. When she passes away, several members of her family come to stay at the house for a time being. But her will gets contested because when she was still alive, toward the end of her life, she started to lose it a little bit. What we would now recognize as dementia, they didn't really know about that at that time. They just thought she was acting crazy or just being mean for no reason. So what happens is before she passes away, her grandson, her adopted grandson, William Chase, comes to her and says, "Grandma, I met this beautiful girl. I love her and I want to marry her. Do I have your approval? What do you think?" And she, for whatever reason, turns to the girl and turns to him and says, "Well, it's either the girl or your inheritance." He chooses the girl. Eliza passes away. And so what happens is he comes to his sister and he says, "Okay, what do I get? Let's split this up. She's dead. You know, where's my cut?" And the sister says, "No, you know, you made your choice. You know, you had your opportunity. Now this is the consequences of it." So it goes all the way up to the Supreme Court. They take each other to the court, goes all the way up to Supreme Court. And as an unfortunate side note of this is that in order to pay off the legal debts, and also because of natural progression and upward expansion here in Manhattan, they have to start selling off pieces of the land to pay off the attorneys and all the legal debts. They also have to start selling off the artwork, things that if we had now would be multi-million dollar pieces. Unfortunately, we don't have them now. So what happens is eventually it goes all the way up to the Supreme Court, and it's believed that the grandson is the one who originates the story of Eliza basically assisting in Stephen's death. Because we don't see any evidence of that while she's alive. We don't start to see stories or rumblings about that until after she's already died. And why we know that is because there was no investigation, there was no police report, there was no rumors about it in the newspapers or anything like that. So we believe that the grandson, being a scorned relative of his grandmother, came up with the story about killing Stephen. So nonetheless, the Jamels, they move on, they move out of the house. And then later on, you have two other families that take over the house in quick succession. You have the LaPrince family and then the Earl family. An interesting thing about the LaPrince family is that a relative of theirs, Louis LaPrince, is one of the gentlemen who's contested as being one of the first inventors of the moving image. And there's a very interesting documentary that came out in the last 2 years. It's called The First Film, and it pretty much documents LaPrince's step-by-step inventing the moving image. And ultimately what happened was he was on his way from France to New York to debut this new machine to all these New York socialites and financial elites. And what he was doing was he was going to try to come here and get a financial backing for his patent. What happens is on that boat trip from France to New York, he disappears. Not only does he disappear without a trace, but so does all of his luggage and the blueprints to his invention. And then lo and behold, who comes out with it a couple of weeks later? Edison. Now, I'm not gonna go into all of the whole, you know, conspiracy theories about Edison, but anyone who does any research about him knows that, you know, he was pretty heavy-handed and he could get things done one way or another. So what was happening was he was going to come here and debut this at his family's house in our Octagon room. So quite literally, our Octagon room was going to be one of the first movie theaters in the world. That's just another interesting story of the house. And so what happens is after the Earl family moves out, they kind of set it up as a mock museum. You know, before museums were even really a thing, Mr. Earl didn't really know what to do with this beautiful historic location. So when he moves on, he gives it over to the city of New York, and New York didn't know what to do with it either. There was all kinds of rumors that they were going to split it up, that it was going to get moved to Pennsylvania, it was going to be turned into a frat house. And so what happens is the Daughters of the American Revolution catch wind of this, that this house is now available. And then it actually becomes a turf war between the DAR, the Daughters of the American Revolution, and then the American Danes, or the Colonial Danes, rather. And so it turns into this really historic kind of nerdy thing where, you know who claims it, who wants it. Ultimately, the DAR, they get the house, and they're here for about 75 years, up until about when the neighborhood starts to get a little dodgy. One of my favorite stories, and I hope that this is true, is that because we have a very big property, 360 degrees around the house, we have a very big northern lawn. one of the rumors is that back in the 70s, these gangs, these female gangs from around Washington Heights would meet and rumble on the North Lawn, which I think which sounds hilarious, but I don't know if it's actually true or not. Nonetheless, so what? So that's pretty much the history of the house. And then after the DAR take over the house in 1904, it becomes a museum. And despite the fact that Roger Morris lived here and all these other families lived here and Eliza Janelle was the longest resident, all the incredible things that she did, they only focus on the 5 weeks that Washington was here, and that's it. It's called the Washington Headquarters, and that's what it's known as until, like I said, about the 70s or so. And then in more recent history, you know, we absolutely embrace the entire history of the house, and it serves as a museum to this day. It's one of the oldest museums in the city of New York as well, and we have over, you know, 30,000 guests a year, 10,000 school kids come here on field trips, so it's a very active museum. We have programming and weddings and all kinds of private and public events, so yeah, so it still serves as a museum to this day.
Now, what was your initial involvement with the house? I know you're very passionate about it. How did you first know about it? Was it a field trip in school, or was it just kind of always there? How did you first get involved?
My first knowledge of the house came by way of a bachelor party. And so I myself, in addition to being a full-time employee here at the mansion, I'm the programming manager here. So any of the concerts, the lectures, anything like that, I'm the one who schedules those and develops those. Outside of that, I'm also a paranormal investigator, which is what led me to this amazing location. A friend of mine was getting married, and this is a guy that I would investigate with as well. And so we said, hey, what do you want to do for your bachelor party? And being that we're such wild and crazy guys, we said, let's go on a ghost hunt. And so I went onto Google, I looked up a couple of places, and I honestly think it was like number one or number two listed on Google as haunted locations in New York. And I called up and I said, hey, is this something that, you know, are you guys open to paranormal investigations? And, you know, everything is so in life, everything is so comes down to being in the right place at the right time and timing, because if I had made that phone call 2 years earlier, they would have said no. But what happened was, you know, former administration, they would have never talked about the ghost stuff. They never acknowledged it. They didn't want to. At that time, there was a brand new executive director, and she said, yeah, sure, why not? Let's embrace it. Let's talk about it. And so they said, yeah, you know, we do public, and they weren't doing public investigations. They were just doing like private ones. So they said, yeah, if you want to rent it out, you can do that. So we booked a private investigation, and one day I get a phone call from the woman who I had to book it with, and she starts asking me all these questions that I thought were kind of weird, but at the same time, I just was like, okay, this is how it must be. But she starts asking me, what kind of equipment do you use? What kind of methods do you use? Are you a member of a team or anything like that? So I said, you know, I gave her the answers. And then she revealed to me that what they were doing was they were looking for a paranormal team or investigator or investigators to lead a public investigation for Halloween, which like I said, going back to being in the right place at the right time, I jumped at the opportunity. So we led that, me and my friend. And then when I came back on that second investigation, I met the executive director and we got to talking. She found out that my academic background was in theater. That's what I went to school for, upstate New York. And she then asked me, hey, would you be interested in writing a play for us to debut next October, which would be October of 2015? And I said, absolutely, because at that point in my life, I was actually working as an EMT on an ambulance. And so that was like my survival job when I was, you know, scrounging around looking for theater work. That's what I would be doing to pay the bills and going to grad school. And so I started working on the play, and while I was working on the play, I was offered a full-time job as a programming manager because they saw that I had an extensive background in organizing events and producing events. So I stepped off the ambulance and I came here as a full-time employee. And when I did that, I said, hey guys, you know, listen, this is something I've been doing for a while, and you know, I know that's not something you're very familiar with, but I'll have you know that elsewhere, this is a very popular topic and that this is something that people would pay money to come in and support the mansion and do an investigation. And if you're willing, let's give it a shot. So they were willing. And our first public investigation, it was on Halloween, it sold out. And then we were like, okay, let's do it again. So we did another one and so on and so forth. And it has now become, a couple of years later, it is now our most consistent attended event. It sells out every time. And the most important thing is that every single cent of it, of these investigations, they don't go to me. They don't go to any other staff member. It all goes back to the house and maintaining the house. So that's how I became a part of this building. And in working here and being the paranormal face of the building, it's exposed me to pretty cool opportunities. I have since become a member of a group called Gotham Paranormal Research Society, which is a TAPS family. So we cover the Metro New York area. So it's led to some pretty cool opportunities and be able to meet and speak with some pretty cool people, such as yourself.
So tell me more about when you first got into the house, and maybe this was during the bachelor party or whatnot, but what was your first experience in the house? Before we even get there, when did you first hear about hauntings of the house? Was it just when you Googled it?
So the first time, the way it all went down was when after I booked it and I called my friend up and I said, hey, you know, we got a location, we're good to go. He goes, where is it? I said, it's called the Morris something. I don't know. He goes, oh, the Morris Chimel Mansion? I said, yeah. He goes, oh, that was on Ghost Adventures.
Okay.
And I said, oh, okay. And so then we watched the episode prior to coming here. And I'll be honest with you, they didn't do a great job. They really didn't explore the entire house. Maybe they did, but they didn't show that on camera. They probably didn't get a lot of evidence that night. That's why. But that's really when I first heard of the paranormal happenings here.
Okay. What was your first experience in the house when you began to investigate it?
My very first significant experience investigating here was actually the night of the bachelor party. And by the way, when I say bachelor party, it was not at all a rager. It was just you know, three of us walking around the dark. And as a matter of fact, one of my friends had been working all day, and he fell asleep in every room. So that gives you an idea of how much of a rager it was. But our first experience here was that night, and we started in the basement in what's now the Colonial Kitchen. And this was, in fact, where the servants would work all day preparing food. We were down there in the dark, and all of a sudden, we started to hear the sound of a bell ringing. Now, what's really interesting about this is that there were three guys and one girl on the investigation. The three guys all could hear the bell. The girl could not. And it was so loud that we actually picked it up on our digital recorder. So she has no idea how she didn't hear it in real time. And we were all sitting in the same location, but somehow she didn't hear it. What's interesting is that when we came back the second time to lead a Halloween investigation, my friend had the sound of a bell on his phone, and we tried something called a Singapore effect, which is when you recreate a sound or an action or an activity synonymous with a spirit's lifetime. So being that we had that little clue on our first investigation of the bell ringing, he had the sound of the bell on his phone. He goes up onto the first floor with the guest. We all stayed in the basement, and he starts playing the sound of the bell. He plays the sound of the bell, and he goes, I want my supper, he says very loudly. All of a sudden, they could hear in the dark, they heard something scurrying down the steps, and then the motion sensor lights in the dining room went off. When they came back down the stairs to the basement, the kid that went up with him when he went up there, total skeptic, did not believe in ghosts. This kid came down, literally looked like he saw a ghost. And for the rest of that night, this kid was like hooked on us and was like asking all these questions. So that was a pretty cool moment as an investigator. But that was pretty much one of the most significant first events that I experienced here.
Sure. Quite a interesting personal first experience with the building itself and the history. Now that obviously you're a part of it as being an employee there, I'm sure you've heard many stories of paranormal activity there. How far back does it go? What is the first known rumored probably paranormal event that is shared about that property? How far back does that go, and what is it?
So luckily for us, the paranormal activity didn't start when I started working here, because that, you know, there's no credibility to that. I mean, any one of us could be like, oh yeah, this place is haunted. Give us money to come and investigate. But the documented activity actually goes back to 1810 when Eliza Jamel moves in, and she herself claims to hear voices, see things, feel things, and then that actually increases after she passes away and her family is staying here. They claim to see her, hear her. One of the creepiest things I've ever heard about this house was that in her bedroom, one of her family members claimed to hear her fingers rapping on either side of a porcelain bowl, which is really, really creepy to think of. The visual, the audio of that is really scary. But so it goes back to the 1800s, because at that time this was already someone's house, this was already a military occupancy, and it was already a tavern. And then they moved in. So much has happened here. Now people ask how many people have died here, going back to the Hessian soldier, and you know, I said supposedly. Here's the thing. You get two supposed deaths and two confirmed deaths. You get the two supposed are the Hessian soldier who falls on his bayonet, a servant girl who hangs herself in the stairwell, and then the two confirmed deaths are Stephen Jamel and Eliza Jamel. Now, with that said, I always say this house is over 250 years old. Who knows what else happened here? This did serve as a military occupancy, so very well, someone could have been injured in battle and then died overnight. Someone could have died in the park, something, you know, someone could have died while they were traveling and just was never documented. Just recently, we found out that someone is buried on the property, which sounds crazy to hear, but here's why it makes sense. So there's a book called Yankee Doodle Soldier, and it's actually a published diary of a colonial soldier. And in it, he talks about walking along a path with the comrade, and they find a fallen soldier. So they bring him back to the Morris estate, which is this house, and they bury him on the property. Now, that very well is possible, but as I said, the original property was, you know, what is now the equivalent of 40 city blocks, sure. And it would go river to river. So could someone have been buried on the property? Absolutely. But would we have found them by now with all the work that's been done on the property? Yes, we would have. So the ghost stories go back to, like I said, the 1800s. Our most significant story takes place January of 1964. So we have field trips here almost every week, and it was no different in the 60s. It was one way that they kept the house open. So you get a group of school kids waiting to be let in for a field trip, and they're being allowed, and they're carrying on, and they're out in front of the house. On the slate, and then this is in front of the big porch with the columns and the balcony, and they're just being allowed, they're carrying on, they're being kids. All of a sudden, this woman in a dress, in this black dress, comes out and tells them, shut up or go away, and disappears. It kind of scares the hell out of them, but they're like, they're more confused than anything. So then all of a sudden, the curator comes running up and says, I'm so sorry, I'll let you guys in, there was a problem with the subway. And so they said, that's fine, no problem. But I apologize, you know, we disturbed a woman in the house. We're really sorry about that. And she says, what are you talking about? They said, the woman, your volunteer or whatever, came out in the dress and she yelled at us. They thought she was a costumed employee for the tour. And she says, there's no one in the house. I'm the only one with the keys. So they're like, what? No, this woman came out. They go back and forth. They come into the house and they look up and they see the big portrait of Eliza Jamel with her grandkids. And they say, that's the woman. Eliza was dead over 100 years at this point. So what happens is this story eventually gets into the newspapers around New York and eventually gets the attention of Hans Holzer, you know, famed parapsychologist. At this point, he was teaching over at NYU. He was teaching parapsychology. And somehow, some way, he convinces the administration here to let him come in and do not one but two seances. And this is really bizarre because at that time, as I said earlier, they did not talk about the ghost stuff. They talked about Washington, and that was it. Matter of fact, in our archives, we have at least three big boxes of letters of people, you know, letters, newspaper articles, all dating all the way back to the 60s, people writing to the mansion, requesting information. And luckily for me, when I was writing my play, they saved all of this. They saved all of it. And they did not talk about it. They, you know, people requesting information about the ghost, requesting to come here and do an investigation. And they said, nope, we don't do that. We don't talk about it. There are no ghosts. And it pretty much goes on to this day. We have so much activity here. We have people come here every day and they're like, oh, is the place haunted? And, you know, have you ever experienced anything? To which we say, yeah, how much time do you have? Because we have things happen almost on a daily basis. It's gotten so frequent that I decided to start keeping a journal of everything in our gift shop. So now anytime a staff member has an experience, they write it down in the journal with their name and the date, and eventually that's going to go into our archives. So yes, we have activity going all the way back to the 1800s up until this week.
That wraps up part one of our interview with Vincent Carbone about the haunted Morris Jamel Mansion. In part two of our interview, we'll find out what happened when famed paranormal investigator Hans Holzer requested to visit the mansion and hold a seance. What were the identities, or what are the identities, of the ghosts who haunt the Morris Jamel Mansion to this day? What causes activity to spike at the mansion? Has any employee ever called it quits because of the paranormal activity? What message was a disembodied voice trying to give a staff member late one night in the kitchen? What happened when a television series was trying to film in the Morris Jamel Mansion? And is anything dark living there? Until next time, for the Grave Talks, I'm Tony Bruschi. Thanks for listening.